I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join us on our quest to find awe and wonder in all nature, human or wild, vast or small. A podcast in search of all that moves us beyond words. Your host for this episode is Tenery Taylor.
If you're of a certain age, you may have a memory similar to this one.
My parents collected National Geographic magazines, and they all have like this pull-out poster in the middle. I was probably 12, 13 years old, and we got one that was space-related. So I remember taking it into my room, and I'd sit on the bedroom floor, and the first thing I would do would be to open up that poster in the middle of the magazine. And in this one, it was like a white rectangular sheet of paper, and it had this oval drawing on it. For the life of me, I can't remember if it was known universe, observable universe, but it was this oval drawing. And like we always do with maps, I went to the You Are Here thing, you know, found where we are, like our solar system, the Milky Way galaxy, and all that stuff. And then I just remember kind of looking out from that and getting to the edge of that oval drawing and just sitting there, mind boggled as it is still today when I think about any representation of our universe. And I just was like, oh my gosh, what's all this white stuff around the oval drawing? What's all this, the rest of this sheet of paper? And at that time I was like, well, maybe that's what they mean by infinity, or is that heaven? Is the oval drawing sitting inside of heaven? And then you look at the edge of the paper and that rolls to the bedroom floor and then to the wall of the bedroom and out the window. And I get goosebumps thinking about it today. I'm like, even if you thought about it three-dimensionally, like an egg or some volume, I was like, what is it in?
That's Nicole Stott. A couple decades after contemplating that National Geographic map of the cosmos, she got a lot closer to that unknown frontier, that white stuff surrounding the oval depiction of the universe. On August 28, 2009, she found herself in a seat few of us ever get to occupy.
You've been sitting in that place, laying on your back, waiting to go for a couple hours now, just really quietly, peacefully, maybe even napping while you're waiting to go. And then out of nowhere, it seems, comes this energy from those boosters. I mean, on the shuttle, it was like 7 million pounds of exploding rocket stuff underneath you. It takes a lot. The Earth has this hold on us. It doesn't want to let go, you know? So it takes a lot to kind of hurl us out into space and get us orbiting the planet.
Nicole Stott is a retired NASA astronaut, describing for us there the liftoff of the space shuttle. With two missions for NASA and a total of 104 days of spaceflight to her credit, Stott is the author of Back to Earth, What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It. That transition to weightlessness, for her, eventually leads to an even greater thrill.
Your arms, if you relax, want to float up, kind of in this, my son called it like space zombie position. Just everything wants to float. And you cannot wait. You cannot wait to float out of your seat and get to the window.
So, tell me about the window.
Nothing prepares you for it. I mean, I worked really hard talking to my colleagues who had flown before, to my friends, to looking at the pictures and videos. And I think you have an expectation of what it's going to be like.
But turns out you can't really study up on your first view of the Earth from space.
You are overwhelmed by the beauty of it, the clarity of it, the color of it. I mean, all of it was like the brightest thing I'd ever seen with all the colors you know Earth to be. I don't remember where it was the first time when I floated up into one of those space shuttle windows and looked out. I do not remember where we were. I know there was water, but I was just so captivated by the color and the brightness that was just well beyond what I had even imagined. And very grateful that sense of awe, that sense of wonder looking out that window, never dulled.
When the space shuttle docked at the International Space Station, after traveling for a day and a half, there was more anticipation.
I was thinking, oh, what's it going to be like to step inside this new place that I'm going to call home? And then I realized, wow, I'm not stepping at all. I'm floating, I'm flying, I'm just moving freely into this place, which in comparison to the inside of the space shuttle, which in the grand scheme of things is a large volume for a spacecraft, oh my gosh, it's like this whole place just opened up around me. The space station is ginormous inside.
Stott described for me how the space station is made up of many modules, each the size of a school bus.
They're all interconnected. We can float from one to the other, from one end of the space station to the other. They equate the size of the like living volume on the space station to like that of a big six-bedroom house. But the bonus that we get on the space station, in space, we're floating. So we get to use the whole volume of that place. So it just becomes, I mean, physically and I think psychologically, you feel like you are in a much bigger place than you would if that module was down here on Earth. So I never felt confined on the space station. I always felt like I just had this beautiful volume to move through. I could float up to the ceiling, to the side of the wall, you know, from one end to the other flying. And it always very much felt open and liberating, even, I think is a word I like to use about how you can move around this place.
Floating to the ceiling may have been thrilling, but it seems she was most obsessed with the windows.
When I first got there, I'm like, oh, you know, I wonder if I'll just fly by the window now and I won't stop to look. Or I wonder if it's just going to get kind of like, oh, let's pull the window shade down and watch the movie kind of thing. And I never, ever got to that place. It was always surprising. I don't know. There was just something new every time you experienced it. And I found I really had to, during the workday especially, kind of temper myself to say, okay, Nikki, you're going to go to that window. You've got a couple seconds, you know, a couple minutes maybe to experience it, take a picture maybe, and then you need to move on because you're there to work. And it was a very transcendent kind of experience to be able to be in that place, floating above that window.
Before we move on to the work she was there to do, let's not skip too quickly over this experience at the window. I wanted to know what kinds of thoughts were going through Nicole's head during these moments. What did and does transcendent mean to her personally?
I know it was pretty powerful, compelling to think that way, to see and experience our home from that vantage point. And then, of course, I thought of it all in a spiritual way. And I think you could consider that spiritual nature in many different ways. I am a person of faith. I grew up as a Catholic. I have a, you know, kind of this Christian background. I will say I'm not, you know, actively religious in any way, but it's there. It's in me. And I remember thinking about that when I was looking out the window, like, oh my gosh, just the how of it. How is any of this possible? And in doing that, I even like before flying to space, I remember speaking to people who had flown before me, my colleagues, you know, reading about it, trying to get a sense of how awesome it was all going to be. And that mostly was associated with this view of Earth and our place in space. And some of the early guys, some of the Apollo astronauts, where they described looking back at Earth and getting this sense of how insignificant we are in the grand scheme of this universe. And these were men that were seeing like the whole planet as this sphere out the window, or Earth rising above the horizon of the moon, you know, like in that iconic Earthrise image. And they used the word insignificant. And from the first time hearing that, even before I was preparing to fly in space, I'm like, man, I hope they mean like humbled, in awe of, you know, that kind of thing, not like a negative, oh, we're insignificant kind of deal. And so I thought about that when I first got to space, and it stayed with me the entire time. And I can tell you, I mean, I never got any sense of insignificance. I certainly got sense of, wow, we are small in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, and the kind of on the line of size doesn't matter. It's like this, you know, this was not insignificant, that we right now, you and I are on this planet perfect distance from the sun. You know, a little closer, a little further, not so good for us. But on this place that's perfectly designed for us. And I remember being in awe of that. Like, wow, how did we get so lucky? Or how was this created? Or how did that play into my whole understanding of what faith is and kind of this overarching spiritual nature of it, the zen of it, you know, to be in kind of a meditative, transcendent state that I hadn't ever really experienced before. And, you know, the kind of thoughts that can come from that. And it's kind of why I have always thought there should be no conflict between science and religion, right? There's these unknowns in both of them in some way. You know, on the religion side, we have this faith in what has occurred and how we exist and the idea of a creator, if you will. There's certainly something out there that has allowed this all to happen. And I'm personally of the opinion that a religious, creative nature of that, a God, if you will, could be part of that scientific answer to how this all exists. That's equally as possible as this is in a universe expanding into what?
Remember that young teen, incredulous about that dizzying map of the universe?
We should be open to the idea of, are there more of these oval drawings in this white space? Everything about it had this spiritual sense to it. The floating, the flying, the opportunity to work with people in a place like that on something that really was a mission of greater good, was off the earth for the earth, was meant to ultimately be about improving life on earth, and that transcendent feeling of, you know, acknowledging who and where we all are in space together.
I love so much that transcendence for Nicole leads her to think about a sense of community. And notice she said, where we all are in space together. She's not limiting herself to the space station crew. She's talking about the residents of planet Earth. By the end of this episode, you'll understand that we wanted to talk to this astronaut, not just to experience through her the awe and transcendence of being in space, but also we're going to get a new perspective on life here on Earth. We'll get to that perspective once we followed Nicole Stott's spaceflight all the way through to her return to Terra Firma. For now, let's get back to her time in space. Notwithstanding the attraction of the view out the window, Nicole Stott never forgot her duties and assignments. She did keep in mind that she was there to work. For one thing, there's always maintenance. And for obvious reasons, maintenance on the space station sounds a lot more fun than my home repair projects.
I had the opportunity to do one spacewalk very early in my first spaceflight, and it was about 6.5 hours outside. We were crawling around the outside of the International Space Station. Most of the work was maintenance related. We were removing this big box, this ammonia tank that had failed in some way off the space station, and we were going to take that back down into the space shuttle for them to return it home. And then my astronaut buddies were going to come out the next day and replace it with a new tank. We also were pulling some science experiments off of the station that were going to get sent back to Earth for the scientists to study. Had the opportunity to ride on the big robotic arm. I don't know if you've seen on the space station, we have this crane-looking kind of thing that we move equipment with. We move people around with it too. And I had pulled off this box, this piece of science hardware, off the end of one of the modules at the space station. And my feet were strapped into the end of this robotic arm. And this box, I still think about it today. I'm like, oh my gosh, this box down here on Earth would weigh about 900 pounds. But up there, I'm strapped my feet into the end of this crane looking thing. And I'm holding on to this box and just like, hold on to this box. Like, not thinking about the weight of it at all. And got to travel on the end of that arm for like 20 minutes from the end of the space station on this big arc down into the payload bay of the space shuttle. And it was the most peaceful, comfortable 20 minutes, I think, of my entire time in space. It was awesome, for sure. You know, I'm out there by myself in my own little personal spaceship, holding on to this box, and I'm riding on the end of this arm, and I never felt like I moved. The space station moved out of my view. I saw Earth rotating below me in my view, and then out of nowhere, it's like the payload bay of the space shuttle popped up. And I felt like I was just standing there watching everything else kind of move around me. And it was awesome. I think awesome is a word that you can use associated with pretty much anything to do with spaceflight. But that spacewalk timeframe was one where it certainly applied.
Now, sometimes jobs performed on the International Space Station appear to be like any other kind of work. Routine, matter of fact, a lot of lab studies. And the importance of this type of work sometimes gets lost on us back here on Earth when we're celebrating, you know, the sheer marvel of space travel. But there's a lot of work going on in that six-bedroom house orbiting 250 miles above us. Work that can impact life on the blue marble below.
The way we built that place, it is the best example of living off the grid that you can find. Those ginormous solar panels, we are collecting all the energy from that. The way we generate clean drinking water now is all internal to that space station.
How is that done?
So
do I want to know?
Yeah, well, you might not. But so all of the moisture that we collect on the station, that includes what we as humans create on board the station, it gets recycled into clean drinking water. I think at least 90% of the clean drinking water now is recycled water. It's not having to be sent from Earth anymore to space. And that same system has been brought back to Earth, modified in a way that places on Earth that never had clean drinking water before now can experience that as well, thanks to what we had to develop to go to space. In cooperation with the scientists here on Earth, any area of science you can imagine is being studied. We are guinea pigs for being in that kind of environment where you float and you don't have load on your body, and they look at accelerated aging. We can look at things like osteoporosis and heart issues, stroking and vision in ways that you can't down here in a gravity environment.
Muscles and bones atrophy at a dramatic pace in the absence of gravity. So the astronauts have to deliberately counter these effects with specialized exercises. In a sense, the astronauts' natural aging process is turbocharged in space. This means that scientists studying aging can get longitudinal data much more quickly when their subjects are weightless. And cancer cells grow more quickly in space, which expedites lab research in this area too.
And the scientists love it because they can take gravity out of the equation and they can look at stuff in a whole new way. And then everything we're doing in space, we bring back to Earth in a way that is about observation of the planet as well. We have very purposeful instruments on board the station that are measuring the vital signs of our planet and providing the scientists and the people who need it with the data they need to solve the most challenging planetary issues that we have. So everything about space is bringing benefit back to Earth.
Like greenhouse gases, you're measuring that, or methane leaks or things like that?
Yeah, there are instruments that can pretty much measure any characteristics of the planet you want. Ocean temperature, carbon dioxide, methane, like you just mentioned, and the changes in ice structure on Earth. We look at algae blooms, radiation, the ozone layer. And I mean, the way we got the first information about that to really make decisions was through a satellite from space, that data.
But from the space station, instruments can be calibrated and trained to collect data beyond the reach of satellites. NASA gathers and analyzes information from all these sources.
There's a place in DC called the Earth Information Center that takes all of this data and presents it to you in almost an artistic way. So you can see, here's what's going on with carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, and here's why we care about it. Oh, and here are some of the things we could maybe even do about that to shift what might be getting worse and actually make it better.
I encourage you, not right now, but maybe after this episode, to peek at earth.gov, hosted by the Earth Information Center. There you'll find the Live Earth dashboard, where you can check out the Earth's vital signs in vivid color. NASA is one of the many contributors to this website. Again, you can find it at earth.gov. For all their work assignments, astronauts are also instructed to plan for some R&R on the space station.
I'm very grateful to one of my support people, Mary Jane Anderson. She was one of the people that helped pack all of our stuff to go to space. And, you know, we get focused on our checklists and bringing things for our family and wanting to share the experience with other people. And she reminded me, she's like, Nicole, you know, you're going to be living there for months at a time. Think about bringing something small that you enjoy doing on Earth that you might want to do in space as well. Long story short, that became a little watercolor kit. It was absolutely one of the personal highlights of flying in space for me to be able to paint at night just a little bit. I painted a view of a place that I thought was really beautiful on Earth. When I looked through the window, it looked like somebody had reached a big paintbrush down already and painted a wave on the ocean. This tiny little chain of islands on the northern coast of Venezuela called Las Rocas. And as you can imagine, you can't float in front of the window and paint what you're seeing because, you know, at 5 miles a second, it's going to be gone before you can get the brush to the paper.
So she snapped a photo and sent it to the printer right there at the space station.
I was able to print out a picture of it and then just use that as my reference and paint it a little bit every night. And had to learn.
But you're making it sound so easy.
I know.
Getting the brush to the paper is actually not that easy in space.
It's
I want
not
you
that
to talk
easy.
Us through
yeah,
that because it's kind of
It's
crazy.
Very different. It's very different. And what I love about it, like the painting, I wish I would have videotaped it. I have one picture of painting in space. I wish I would have videotaped the whole process because everything about it was different. It wasn't necessarily more difficult. It was just different. And you have to learn that about everything you're doing up there, how you eat, how you float, how you wash your hair, do science. It's all a little bit different, but not necessarily more difficult. And so instead of a cup of water, because we don't have cups of water, I would dip my brush in this floating ball of water. And the little ball of water, it was kind of attracted to the end of the brush. It was so cool to watch. I'm dipping my brush in it. And taking that down to the paint and watching how the water moved to the paint became this colored blob of water that then I had floating on the end of my brush. And learning that if I actually painted with the brush, if I touched the brush to the paper, the whole blob of colored water would just transfer to the paper. And so I had to figure out, okay, how far do I have to pull the brush off the paper to be able to actually drag the ball of water along the paper? It just was this really wonderful experience. I really think about it. What humans do, no matter where we go, we take what we love with us. It's like putting a human in human spaceflight. And art and music and poetry and my friend Karen Quilted. I mean, that's been going on in space since the very beginning of humans in space. And so all these people that you think of as sciencey technical astronauts, they got some creative stuff going on too, which is nice to know.
Nicole Stott is the author of Back to Earth, What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It. You might have inferred already from that title, but there's a clear sense that life up there for Nicole changed life down here. More on how she now sees with new eyes coming up in just a moment. I'm Tenery Taylor, and this is Constant Wonder. At the end of her second trip to the International Space Station, Nicole Stott was really torn about going home.
But I just remember as I was getting ready to leave thinking, oh my gosh, you know, will I ever experience anything like this again? And there's video. I mean, they literally had to pull my clawing hands off the hatch to get me back in the shuttle to come back. And a lot of it was because of that, I don't know, that very human experience of appreciating something that you thought you knew so well with your feet on it, and just getting this totally different perspective of it from that view, you know, through the window of a spaceship. I'm pleased to say that I feel that kind of thing in many different ways now here on Earth. Very grateful to know that my heart, my mind are opened up to that kind of awesomeness, that kind of wonder that surrounds us every day.
Okay, so you're saying that you're seeing Earth differently now, that you didn't have quite that sense of awe before you went into space that you now have. Is that what you're saying?
I am. And I wish that, you know, a lot of people want to go to space because they want to experience, you know, what Frank White coined as the overview effect, or to get this sense of our planetary home in a way that they just haven't from down here on Earth. I feel kind of sad that my acknowledgement of that had to come through looking out the window of a spaceship, right? But seeing Earth from space, it really resonated in a way that I wanted to bring back to Earth, and I wanted everybody else to understand, and I want them to understand it in a way that says you don't have to fly on a spaceship to appreciate this about, you know, our planetary home.
So how do you feel like you can convey that without a sense of, well, you can't really know what it is because I went to space and you're not ever going to go to space?
First of all, I don't like to say you're not going to experience it because you aren't going to go. I would like to believe that anybody who wants to go will be able to do that. That might be a bit of a ways off, but I'm hopeful. The way I like to say it is, and I think this is true, I think that the experience really, what did it for me to open up, and I say this, my heart, my mind, to just being more aware of what's around me all the time. Things like meditating have put me in that same kind of place, the same feeling I had floating in front of that window where I had to set my timer to remind myself to go back to work. You know, kind of that transcendent sense of separation and acknowledgement that, you know, you can get through meditation or through earthing. But I'm looking out my window right now at the, you know, the water and the canal behind me and the flowers on the tree. And I know in some ways it sounds a little bit kumbaya, but I'm like, man, if you really take the time to just suck that in, I get equally as compelling a feeling doing that, getting my feet in the dirt and just acknowledging that I'm standing on a planet, as I did floating in front of the window, looking back at it.
Did you just say the word earthing?
I did.
As a verb?
I did.
Tell me more about that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, and it's something I had no idea about this either before I flew in space, so I like to share it as well. When I got back from space, I hadn't ever meditated really before, not in a ritual way or in kind of a regular way. And I got introduced to meditation, and then along the way, I'm like, oh, okay, I need to go off and buy a yoga mat. And and as I'm searching for one, I came across this idea of earthing. I'm like, oh my gosh, what is that? That sounds so cool. Because I think about us as earthlings and how do we make this better connection emotionally, psychologically, physically with Earth. And so I went off and looked it up, and it speaks to this connection we should have with the planet. It speaks to this idea of how everything is charged around us. Our bodies have a charge, the planet has a charge, the air is charged in particular ways. And by allowing ourselves to connect with Earth, we can balance out our bodies through that charge of the planet. And so earthing encourages you to get your shoes off, go stand in the dirt, stand in the sand, stand in the grass, to think about that physical connection you have with the planet, and then just chill, meditate, if you will, and allow it to just become part of you. And I love it because even though what I read didn't say, okay, every day you need to think about the fact that you live on a planet, I loved adding that into kind of my practice of earthing, where it's like, this is more than just a physical, electrical, if you will, connection. This is absolutely about the interconnectivity of everything. And so for me, I wake up in the morning, my feet hit the ground, and the first thing I think about is the fact that I live on a planet in space. And that we right now, you and I, are on our different places on it, but we are spinning at 1,000 miles an hour. We're circling the sun at 67,000 miles an hour. And yet we just feel like we're in the place we're supposed to be. Like this was meant for us to be here. And in reality, we are. I mean, this planet's our home. It's our life support system. Everything about it is connected to us in one way or another.
So you've been talking a lot about your personal connection to the Earth. How about a sense of connectedness to other Earthlings? I've read about how you were kind of trying to find your home from space. And that kind of led you down a thought process about what does home really mean? So I'd love for you to explore that with us a little bit.
I think that's what I came to in space, really, having that opportunity to view Earth through the window, to be separated in that way and appreciate it from that vantage point. And when I think about it, you know, kind of the hindsight of it is, man, I got there, I wanted to look out the window, I wanted to see whatever I was going to see, right? I just wanted to see it. And then I very quickly was like, okay, Florida is going to be out that window. I want to be in front of that window. I want to be taking pictures of Florida. I'm sitting at my house in Florida right now. And I had this idea in my mind that Florida was my home. I needed to see Florida, appreciate it from that place. And it was interesting to me how quickly, though, that transitioned to just appreciating the beauty of what I was seeing out the window, appreciating certainly Florida and its place on that planet I was seeing out the window, the art of it all. I mean, it looked like this work of art, surprising you every time with the patterns and the colors. I think also appreciating the contrast. I mean, every time, didn't matter what you were seeing out the window, it was beautiful. And yet, I know from being here on the planet too, that that swirling white, fluffy looking hurricane that's moving across the ocean that looks so stunning through a space station window is anything but from down here on Earth. So kind of this contradiction and the way you can look at things and how you need to appreciate that. And it made me realize that Florida was part of a planet that's my home. And that then extended to this idea of, oh my gosh, if we can live like crewmates on this machine in space, if we can appreciate all of what we need to do to sustain life in this place, and we can appreciate and acknowledge the health and well-being of all of our crewmates on this machine in space, we absolutely need to be doing that on our planetary spaceship. And so for me, the ultimate lesson in it all was, how do we accept our role as crewmates and not passengers on spaceship Earth? And that's what home is about to me. This planet is our home, and it's where we share existence with others. And then we need to acknowledge the existence of others when we're in that place. And I really think the simplest way to think about that is to be a crewmate and not a passenger, wherever that place is.
Nicole Stott readily acknowledges that she is not the first person to characterize life on Earth as similar to being a crew on a spaceship. In her book, Back to Earth, she credits Buckminster Fuller for his thoughts on the topic, and she points out that clear back in 1879, the philosopher of economics Henry George called Earth a well-provisioned ship on which we sail through space. But that idea of being a crew member was, of course, made visceral for Nicole during her time in orbit on the International Space Station.
Every day we wake up on that machine in space, and the seven of us, one of the very first things we do is check how much carbon dioxide's in our atmosphere. We check how much clean drinking water we have. We check on the integrity of that thin metal hull that's protecting us from that deadly vacuum of space. And we absolutely check on the health and well-being of all of our crewmates. It just so beautifully translates to the way we should be living and working down here.
Nicole Stott lauds such diverse initiatives as engaging fishermen to fish for litter to remove plastics from local fisheries, to using virtual reality glasses to bring natural wonder to those who physically can't get out into the world, and to using microscopic worms called nematodes instead of pesticides. Now, we've got a whole episode on nematodes, if you're curious. But what I didn't know until I met Nicole was that there's been research done on these tiny creatures up at the space station.
I never wanted to just write a book about, oh, here's how Nikki became an astronaut, right? I felt like there had to be something more to it that spoke to the purpose and the meaning of what, you know, we're doing in space and how that brings back to Earth this idea of behaving like crewmates and not passengers. You know, kids get it. If we're encouraging our kids to be crewmates and not passengers on their planetary home, they're going to grow up embedding that in the things they want to study, the work they want to do, how they bring that to life around them. And the same is true on a university board where you're trying to influence in some way the students' minds and hearts with respect to what they're studying there and how hopefully what they're studying is something they want to take forward into life to improve life for themselves, their families, and the other people in life they share the planet with.
Let's consider another angle on daily life on the space station and how her time there inspired Nicole to promote this idea that we all ought to act more like crewmates on this spaceship we call Earth. First of all, it's the International Space Station. Someone's got to figure out who gets to go in the first place. there has to be a multilateral agreement about which countries will send the half dozen astronauts to inhabit and run the space station.
We're partnered with the Canadian Space Agency, the Russian Space Agency, European Space Agency, which represents 11 or 12 different countries, and the Japanese Space Agency. And so all of our crews, whether we have a person from that country or not on board with us, we are representing as one crew with one commander who might be from any one of those different countries. But it's incredible to me how, with the International Space Station program, we've had people representing 15, 16 different countries for over 25 years now, working peacefully and successfully together on the International Space Station, orbiting the Earth 16 times a day together, you know, in this place, working for the benefit of life on Earth. And some of those countries are not having such a great time here down on the planet. And yet we've managed to bring that peace and success to life in this place. And that, when I say in this place, it's not just the six or seven people on that machine, right, on that space station. It's the tens of thousands of them down here on Earth that have decided this has purpose and we need to continue working together on it. I think that is hugely beneficial to the relationships we have around the world down here on Earth. And I think that countries that are involved with the International Space Station program are acknowledging that in the decisions they're making with respect to some not so nice stuff down here on the planet that I believe would be even not nicer if we didn't have these relationships in place.
What does being a crew member on Spaceship Earth mean to Nicole Stott now that she's retired from NASA? How has she chosen to spend her time and apply her energies differently? One specific choice she's made, one way to contribute to her fellow crewmates' health, is rooted in the activities her parents taught her to love, space and art.
The greatest inspiration I had, it absolutely was my parents. I really feel like they both made a point of sharing what they love with me and my sisters. And my mom, she's an awesome human being. She's a very creative human. When I grew up, it was macrame and hooked rugs and pottery. And she was doing that stuff and taking us with her to do that. And so I think I developed a little bit of the artistic side from all of that. And as a family, we spent a lot of time out at the local airport. My dad was a businessman, but he loved airplanes. He built and flew small airplanes while I was growing up. And I am so thankful for getting to know flying people and wanting to fly myself, but really discovering, wow, I love this flying stuff, but I want to know how things fly. I credit that with setting me on this path of what I studied at school, aeronautical engineering, which I really knew nothing about when I was in high school. Somebody just told me about it. Okay, Nick, if you want to know how things fly, you go study aeronautical engineering. So I just kind of blindly went and did that. And when I graduated from high school was when the shuttle program was getting up and running. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, if you want to know how airplanes fly, why would you not want to know how rocket ships fly? And that, you know, eventually led me down this path of wanting to work for NASA and the space program. And so very grateful for that. And then the little steps happened that allowed the astronaut office to be a reality as well.
It may sound like there's an air of inevitability in the arc that Nicole is describing, but not everyone would have persisted on this path. See, Nicole's father was killed in the crash of his small airplane a week before her 16th birthday. But the future astronaut dealt with this tragedy by leaning into it.
It reinforced kind of the focus for me, which was about how things fly, not just wanting to fly myself, but I want to know how things fly. And I remember, you know, in class, even with my professors, sharing the experience of, you know, the small aircraft accident my dad had and, you know, how does this happen? And I think wanting to get a little more comfortable with all of that. But he loved flying. I mean, absolutely loved it, loved sharing it. Surrounded himself with people that loved flying and just welcomed us to be a part of that. And it definitely got into me more that way than focusing on, oh no, my dad was killed in an airplane crash. I couldn't possibly ever get into an airplane. And God bless my mom, man. You know, when I started talking to her about wanting to learn to fly, about, and then about, oh, I want to fly on rocket ships. This is a woman who has continued throughout all of that to just lift me up. And having a son of my own, I can only imagine the fear that was going on for her, the anxiety maybe that, you know, all of that was doing to her. And yet she just supported every step of the way.
You mentioned your son, and I think this is a little bit of an unfair question. I'll tell you why. But was it hard to leave him? Because he was an elementary schooler, I think, the first time you went to space.
Yeah, he was 7 when I flew the first time, and then 9 the second time. And yeah, I get asked that question. Oh, you were a mom. How could you, you know, I mean, really, like, not nicely like you just did. But like, oh, you're a mom. How could you possibly leave your son and go fly in space and so dangerous and all these kinds of things? And I had to reconcile with all of that for sure. But my ultimate motivation in applying to be an astronaut and wanting to fly in space was not about the adventure side of it. It wasn't, oh, cool, I get to launch on a rocket and I'm going to be flying in this deadly vacuum of space. I mean, it wasn't that. Now, don't get me wrong. I highly recommend those things. It was awesome. But the clincher for me in deciding to fill out the application was more to do with discovering that everything we're doing in space is ultimately about improving life on Earth. And that is what pushed it to the other side for me. And I have a husband who's into the space world in his own way as well, very supportive of all of this, understands that same off the Earth, for the Earth motivation in it. And we worked really hard to ensure that our son felt like he was part of the crew, like he understood the people I was working with, got to know them like family as well, saw the training I was doing, probably could explain better to you what I did in space than I can. I mean, we really wanted him to feel like he was a part of it. And I don't regret any of that at all. And got to share it with him from space in a way that I think is really meaningful for him.
But the unfair part of the question, of course, is that I'm thinking you probably get asked that more than your male counterparts.
I absolutely got and still get asked that more than my male counterparts. And I remember one of the first big press conferences where I got asked that. I'm sitting in line with my 5 or 6 male crewmates. And before I even answered it, I remember looking to my right and looking back at the reporter, and I don't know what my answer was. I was very nice and all of that. But in my mind, I'm thinking every single one of these people is a dad. And every single one of them, I guarantee you, is feeling some of that same parental feeling that we all do, whether we're traveling to space or we're going on a business trip somewhere or we're just driving down the road separate from our kids. They're feeling the exact same thing. And I brought that out in my answer some way, but that's what I've resolved myself to with all of that as well, is that these humans, these male versions, are not feeling this any less than I would be. And they all have their rationale for why they're willing to strap into that rocket and do it. And that's legit, whatever it is for them. But it is interesting. And we fortunately, in the astronaut community, work with a really wonderful mix of people, all different kinds of backgrounds, all countries, all flavors of humans that acknowledge that same thing. We just all bring our best. Human spaceflight, I think, is one of the absolute best examples for demonstrating accelerated evolution with diversity and acknowledging how bringing all these different backgrounds, whatever they are, is to the benefit of the success of the mission.
I mentioned that the types of contributions that Nicole Stott has chosen to make are, in part, a legacy from her parents. Her father's influence is obvious, but her mother's, you know, all that macrame and pottery making, well, that seems to have played out with Nicole embracing the arts. The healing connection of art and space in just a moment. I'm Tenere Taylor, and this is Constant Wonder. In addition to her writing a book that encourages people to think differently about the planet, Nicole Stott is the founding director of the Space for Art Foundation.
We really believe we are uniting a planetary community of children through the awe and wonder of space exploration and the healing power of art. So very simply like space-themed art therapy projects. We started in one hospital, Pediatric Cancer Center in Houston, and that's expanded around the globe. Kids think very creatively about inspiration, about space exploration. And what we found, when you bring those two things together, it allows people to really use that inspiration of space, create something on their own that it is like a transcendent experience. I watched these kids like literally look like they were lifting themselves out of the hospital, out of the refugee camp, just like they were thinking about their futures in a way that they might not have otherwise through the inspiration of space and the ability to create something that, even if they were painting their dog, they're thinking about space and creation in a way that they might not have otherwise.
The Space for Art Foundation has taken some of this art produced by children in hospitals and displayed it in the Space Center Houston and in exhibits in various countries around the world. And they've collected over 1,000 postcards decorated by children in schools and hospitals and made a video compilation for astronauts in the space station. Another project they've done is to collect small pieces of art, triangles only a few inches tall, handmade by kids in cancer wards in hospitals worldwide, and stitched all of those onto a spacesuit, crazy quilt style.
One of our suits we did it during the plague, collected artwork during the COVID timeframe. And that was at a time where every kid was isolated in a way that they never had been before. Every kid was wondering about their own health and their family's health and well-being. Every kid was thinking about these things in a way they never had before. We wanted to involve kids from around the world, and we've got at least one piece of art from, I think, 190 different countries. The spacesuit that was created as the ambassador for Spaceship Earth, you know, representing this connection between personal and planetary health. You can check out the website at Space for Art and see these just beautifully, like tapestries, quilts, like you say, of kids' artwork that have been built by the actual company that made the spacesuit I did a spacewalk in. The company that made the suits that walked on the moon, they have volunteered with us since the very beginning to quilt these kids' artwork together into these suits.
And the astronauts actually wear these quilted suits in space.
So we've been really fortunate. We can never, ever promise that we'll get anything up to space. But we've been very fortunate to have a couple of these suits packed up small and flown to the International Space Station. And yes, some of the astronauts have been able to wear these suits on board the station, float around in them, have some exchange with the kids down here on Earth, and the kids getting to see their artwork as part of that, you know, bigger art piece floating and flying on the space station.
Nicole Stott's book, Back to Earth, What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It, came out in 2021. So just like the children's art she's been describing, it too was produced during the pandemic.
I got a lot of requests for interviews during that whole time of people just wanting to compare. Oh my gosh, you guys must be the best at knowing what it's like to just have to live in this confined space, to not be able to go outside, to not be able to see people that are outside of your immediate family. So I think the lessons and the ways that we live as a family, I like to think as our crew in space, totally apply to the situation that we were in with COVID and the isolation that we were experiencing and the kind of risks that we weren't ever really aware of before were going on around us. I think it totally applies to that. But I think it applies in the bigger scheme of just how we live as crewmates here on a planetary spaceship as well. The purpose in the book to me is to share the story of these ways that we've discovered to live and work peacefully and successfully as this international partnership on a machine in space, right? We've purposely built this space station to mimic as best we can what Earth does for us naturally, right? Just so we can survive in that place. Because we want the humans to be able to go there and do the science and explore and all of the stuff that we do when we're living on a space station. I wanted people to understand that beyond just the science that we're doing there, I wanted people to understand that, man, this comes back to Earth so beautifully. I really do believe that if we accept our role as crewmates and not passengers, we have the power to create a future for all life on Earth that's as beautiful as it looks from space.
Nicole Stott is a retired NASA astronaut. She's the author of Back to Earth, What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It. And she's the founding director of the Space for Art Foundation. This episode was produced by me, Tenery Taylor, with help from Elaine Scott and Marcus Smith. Sound design by James Call and Trent Reimschissel. If you haven't checked out our new podcast for children called Constant Wonder Kids, you ought to go do that right now. It's on all major podcast platforms and on our website. Here's what we've done. We've taken some of our favorite conversations about the world and cut them down bite-sized for elementary schoolers. The first season is all about animals. You can even go to our website at byuradio.org and print out the cutest passport. It looks just like a real one. So your kiddos can check off all the animals they meet this season. We actually think your whole family will have fun listening to these short 12 to 15 minute episodes. Constant Wonder Kids, just like Constant Wonder, is a production of BYU Radio.